Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. And at the controls, who is that guy? I don't recognize him. Mike Pritchard. He is at the controls this morning. Glad to have him on board and glad also to have you listening. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about what was probably one of the most sensational and controversial murder cases to take place in Latin America in modern times. And it happened 10 years ago this month. Bishop Juan Girardi, one of Guatemala's leading human rights activists, was beaten to death, brutally murdered, just a couple of days after presiding over a report implicating the military in the deaths and disappearances of hundreds of thousands of civilians. This was during Guatemala's long civil war. The obvious suspect, a lot of people felt, was the army. However, the Guatemalan government made the argument that it was a crime of passion. This morning, we'll be talking with a writer who has spent a lot of time looking into this murder, trying to understand what happened, and write about what it meant and what it says about the politics of Guatemala. Our guest is Francisco Goldman. He's the author of three novels, The Long Night of White Chicken, The Ordinary Seaman, and The Divine Husband. His fiction and journalism have appeared in a number of places, The New Yorker, Harper's, New York Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine, and he is the author of a recently published book. This is a nonfiction book about the murder of Juan Girardi. The title of the book is The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? It is recently out by Grove Press. So if you're interested in taking a look at the book, you can seek it out in the library or the bookstore. And of course, here on the program, we're welcoming your comments and questions as always. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is we just ask people to keep their comments and questions brief. That way we can keep our program moving along. But, of course, anyone who's listening is welcome to join us. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And also toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Goldman, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
The place to start, I think, is to give people some context for what we're talking about before going on and talking about who Juan Girardi was and about the circumstances of his murder. You probably should talk a little bit about the Civil War in Guatemala, which was one of, in all of Latin America, one of the longest, worst, most destructive wars that took place. And that's saying something. Tell us about the Civil War in Guatemala.
Let's see, the briefest way I can do it is, of course, you know that Guatemala had, from 1944 to 54, its first experiment in democracy after years and years of dictatorships. That experiment ended in 1954 with a CIA-backed coup d'etat against a leftist government led by Colonel Arbenz in the name of, amidst accusations, which in fact were really justified of Guatemala becoming some kind of Soviet beachhead in the area and so forth. What that happened was it not only just destroyed all the reforms that were beginning to happen in Guatemala to correct, you know, various economic injustices, a reversal of the land reform and so forth, because you're talking about a country where, you know, a very poor agricultural country, especially then, basically two crop country, bananas and coffee, and 2% of the wealth back then. I mean, 2% of the population having something like 98% of the wealth in the land. To keep order, after that coup, the military was basically promoted and built up and developed to really be the rulers of that country and to protect that what was then called the oligarchy, you know, the landowning class, you want to call it that. And through the years, though, what happened was the Guatemalan military became very powerful unto itself. It became the one way in Guatemala, which is, almost a 50% Mayan Indian country. Most of the rest of the people, mestizo, became the one way in which somebody kind of from the lower classes could make their way up in society through the army. And So the army became a group that sort of looked after its own interests and almost as greedy and as ruthless as that oligarchy, more greedy, in fact, eventually. And so a war began to happen. It was led by dissident officers. It spread eventually into the mountains. There were lulls in the war. There were peaks in the war. Various fragmented guerrilla groups, most of them communist, some of them not, sometimes fighting together, sometimes separately. The war, you know, eventually ran 36 years, but it was especially intense from 1975 to about 1985. 200,000 people, 200,000 civilians, maybe more, some people say 250,000 civilians, were killed during that war, and the vast majority of them during that 10-year or so period. That war finally began to wind down in the late 80s. The Guatemalan army were the easy victors in the war through their brutality and through their military superiority. Much of that war was waged by conducting a incredibly harsh campaign through the countryside that especially targeted civilian populations, supposedly people who had given, you know, some kind of aid or support to the guerrillas, but it was also you know, a kind of attempt to sort of remake the countryside, the Mayan countryside, in the army's image of what that countryside should be. Anyway, so as you get into the 1980s, Guatemala needs to make peace. It's now seen as kind of an international pariah state. It's been on the UN's list of the world's worst human rights violators for like 19 years in a row. The United States has cut off overt military aid to the Guatemalan army various times, you know, to the Carter, up to the Reagan campaign, because of their really excessive human rights violations. So they need to make peace with the guerrillas, even though they've trounced them. And the army, they need to make peace so they can sort of rejoin the world community. So in the peace accords, which were sponsored by the UN, and start to run through the early 1990s, the army is really dictating the terms. And so what they finally agree on is a peace in which, among other things, there's going to be a blanket amnesty for any of the human rights crimes that occurred during the years of war. In other words, no Guatemalan military officer had ever been tried or brought to justice for any of those 200,000 civilian deaths. And they were saying, that will never happen here. And they agreed that there could be a kind of UN-sponsored truth commission, but they did everything they could to defang it. They said that truth commission wouldn't be able to assign blame, wouldn't be able to say, you know, who did what or name names. It could just kind of, you know, attempt a kind of chronicle of the dead, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that's where Bishop Horati comes in.
And this was as a part of leading an effort by the Catholic Church in Guatemala to document, at least document, what happened.
Yeah, it was really a Quixotic effort at first, because Bishop Horati had taken part in the peace negotiations, and he was appalled, right? He said, basically, this is not how you're going to build a democracy in a country that's going to have sort of justice for people at all levels of society by saying, all those deaths that occurred, all of you who lost family members in the war, forget about it. You're never going to be allowed to find out what happened to your relatives. You're never going to be able to find out the truth. You're never going to be able to seek justice. He said that is wrong. So how are we going to get around this? He said, well, the church didn't sign anything. The church can do a human rights report. And the church had the great, great advantage that they had parishes everywhere. They had a real nationwide infrastructure. You have to remember that Guatemala, what had happened, you know, and how much of what had happened in Guatemala was almost like a part of its geography. It's a very mountainous country. In the mountains where the worst atrocities occurred, it's mainly Mayan Indian, but that Mayan population, they're broken down into various, say, tribal units, and they speak among 16 different languages. And often, through these years of terror, you could imagine the shock and fear that people lived in, and the fear of outsiders, and the mistrust, and the incredible isolation. And often, if people, like in one village, spoke one language, they wouldn't even know what had gone on in the village next to them. It was, you know, and it was just incredible isolation. And really, Bishop Harati felt only the church could break through that because of the trust the church had. And how did he do it? How did he conduct a nationwide human rights report in the most humble, simple way? At the parish level, he just trained people, churchgoers, to go up into those villages with little tape recorders and interview people and ask them what had happened. And these people were trusted and known in the community. And bit by bit, for the first time ever, Guatemalans began to tell their stories. And I don't think the army ever expected that this could be such a successful and thorough effort. So that on April 24th, 1998, in a big ceremony in the Guatemalan National Cathedral, Bishop Harati presented the Recuperation Historical Memory Project report titled Guatemala Never Again, Nunca Más, four big volumes in which he managed to document, even by name, you know, 53,000. The fourth volume is like a big phone book of just the names of 53,000 of the dead. He identified 400-plus of the 600 massacres that we now know occurred. He did name names. He did name military units. He made, let it be known that if the amnesty was ever breached, he would let the documentation, he would make it available for people who wanted to pursue justice against either the army or the guerrillas for atrocities. And he concluded, the people working on it, the church group, they concluded that 80% of the crimes had been committed by the army and 5% committed by the guerrillas. So you can imagine how this hit in Guatemala. When he presented that report, it was certainly seen by the army as not just a challenge to the amnesty, but, you know, an impertinence and something they had never expected to have to deal with when they signed those peace accords. I mean, that's why they had signed the peace accords, to seal all of this off. Mm-hmm. And here he was, you know, he was the incarnation of that famous line, you know, shall someone rid me of this troublesome priest? You know, he was mm-hmm. a troublesome priest. And 2 days later, he was dead.
And we can, you know, we can talk some more about the circumstances of the murder and the way the government reacted and so forth. But just, it must have been everyone, the timing, the release of this very dramatic report, documenting with many, many first person accounts, over 1,000 pages, hundreds of thousands of people died, really laying the blame for the vast majority of the killings at the door of the military. This report is made public, and just a couple of days later, Bishop Juan Corradi is brutally murdered. It must have been that everybody in Guatemala thought that it cannot be an accident that this happened so soon after the release of the report, and it must be that the military was responsible for this murder. There must have been, everybody must have just immediately, automatically thought, well, of course, that's what happened.
Although that was initially the response, but it's important. But within 24 hours, the Army plan to make it look like a crime of passion was already going forward. It's really important to understand how well planned this thing was and how it was laid out and executed, David, like as a piece of theater, mm-hmm. like a really well-organized, well-written, let's say, well-executed, with a few fatal flaws, thank God, piece of theater. You know, people always ask, for example, they say, you know, or initially skeptics would say, well, you know, if it was the army, why would they kill him 2 days after the murder? That doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they kill him before the murder? Right? And I think once you begin to understand the answer to that question is when you start to understand why this book is called The Art of Political Murder, and you begin to understand how political murder works in a country like Guatemala. Because when you have a country like Guatemala where no military man has ever been prosecuted for this kind of crime, for a political assassination, never been brought to justice, you have people who can basically plan murders without fear of consequences. So you can sit down with your fellow officers and say, plan a murder, and it's not part of your calculation that you might have to face justice. So that gives you the freedom to create, really. And they sat there and they must have said something like, what if we can do a murder that won't just get rid of our enemy and punish the human rights community, Bishop Harari, for this report, but will be rigged up in such a way that will not just discredit Bishop Harari, will rain scandal down on the whole church, and will create so much titillation and scandal and lurid soap opera melodrama that everybody, we'll discredit the church, we'll discredit the report itself, and nobody will have any idea what's going on. We'll just create confusion everywhere, and people will forget about the report. And really, they almost succeeded. I mean, and someone would say they did succeed, and maybe only now, finally, are Guatemala's beginning to realize the truth of what happened there. It's been a really long battle. And the way it happened that stage, that very first night. The church was in a downtown neighborhood near some very important military installations, and the center of power, the president's residence, and so forth. But it's an old, dark, Spanish colonial, middle-class neighborhood, very dark at night, and the church was in front of a big park. And in front of that park, in front of the parish house garage, next to the church, every night about 12 homeless vagrants, most of them heavily alcoholic, would lay out their bedding and sleep at night. The church would feed them and so forth, as churches do. And that night, the first act, if this were a piece of theater, the curtain would open, You'd see this quiet park and so forth, and you'd see a man come into the park with carrying 2 liters of beer, uncapped, they've already been opened, and sandwiches, Kraft cheese and white bread sandwiches, as a matter of fact. And he gives them to the vagrants. Not the usual thing, as one of the vagrants usually were called. This stuff we now know was heavily spiked to knock them out, to put them to sleep. Of course, there were 2 vagrants there, one especially, who knew, because they were part of the plan, that they weren't supposed to touch that stuff. Okay? Bishop Harari used to come home every Sunday night. They knew his movements every Sunday night without fail. He would have dinner with his... Bishop's husband was, of course, an Italian Guatemalan. His family had been in Guatemala since the 19th century. He was in his 70s. Big, robust, earthy, wonderful man. Great sense of humor. Hard drinking. Not at all a feat, even though he was a great intellectual. He was a practical intellectual and a real family man. And every Sunday he used to get together with his family, his 81-year-old sister, his nephews, and so forth, and they would have dinner Sunday nights, and then he would drive home. And so, as he always did, he comes up that drive at 10 o'clock at night and pulls up in front of the garage. He would always have to get out, open the garage door himself, and so forth, and come back out and drive the car in. We don't know exactly what happened that night, but at 10:05, that little door in the garage opens, and a man, a very muscular man, wearing no shirt, steps out and allows himself to be seen. He's supposed to be seen, of course, by the one vagrant who hasn't drank anything. Everyone else is knocked out cold, supposedly. He goes walking out of the park. Inside the garage is Bishop Harari's battered, brutally battered body, his face, something like 27 fractures in his face alone, lying on the floor, and beside him, lying on the floor, a sweater, as if though, some act of lust or something had been interrupted, and the man without a shirt has had to leave. Who knows what happened? And within an hour later, 2 hours later, actually, his co-parish priest, Father Mario, claims to discover the body, phones the police. Now, if you're the police, what should you do, right? You should seal off the garage. You should really probably seal off the whole park. The police only put the yellow tape right up around the body. So people start to flood in, reporters, people from the church, people from the UN mission, all spectators. So that crime scene was completely destroyed. As if that wasn't bad enough, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the other priest comes out and starts mopping up the blood, claims that somebody from the prosecutor's office told him to do it. et cetera, et cetera. Nothing was ever going to be taken from that crime scene forensically that could be useful. At 5 o'clock in the morning, in the morgue, it's important to know that whoever planned this murder would have known which prosecution unit would have been on duty that night, right? Mm. Because it goes in rotation. So an assistant prosecutor walks into the morgue, and Bishop Berardi had no history of this kind of sexual activity at all. In fact, if anything, it was the other way. And this assistant prosecutor shouts out, anal swab to check for signs of homosexual penetration, orders from above. And I know this because a very important source for me eventually, the UN mission, probably the one professional policeman type who investigated this murder, but he wasn't allowed to talk to reporters. He wasn't even allowed to really share his information, you know, with justice authorities. He was doing the internal reports for the UN mission. A guy named Rafael Guillemot, an ex-Spanish intelligence agent who ran the UN's investigation, he was in the morgue, and he heard that. And he scoffed later when he said, orders from above, you mean orders from General Espinoza. And General Espinoza was the head of Army intelligence of the Army at that point, the most powerful man in the Army. And the next morning, at an emergency cabinet meeting, he sits down with the president in the shocked cabinet, because this is a murder, of course, is being denounced all over the world, and seems as though it could turn over the peace process and everything. And he says, we have inside information that this was a homosexual crime of passion, but we have to keep this quiet for now. It's a Catholic country. Everybody's in shock. And within days, it starts to get into the press, and it culminates, this big, massive act of theater, culminates July 17th, 4 months after the murder, with the arrest of Bishop Berardi's co-parish priest, Father Mario, as the sole murderer in the case, based on the findings of a very iffy 80-year-old supposed forensics expert in Spain, a guy with a deep right-wing past connected to Franco and everything up, been like a personal physician to Central American dictatorships in the 50s and 60s, a really kind of creepy guy. This doctor in Spain claims to have studied autopsy photographs of the bishop's skull, and discovered signs of dog bites. Mm-hmm. And so Father Mario was arrested, and his 11-year-old German shepherd is taken into custody. And it looks like Act 1, Father Mario is going to be accused as the sole murderer for having... And Padre Mario is a kind of suspicious character. He's not at all like Bishop Berardi. He is a 35-year-old... very libertine, he's kind of like the Imelda Marcos of priests, you know, all the luxury goods they found in his room later and so forth. And, 550 designer shirts, 8 leather jackets from Gucci and so forth. And they pinned the murder on him and claimed that, something happened that had to do with the shirtless man and so forth. And it all looked like it was going to work because if you were, say, one of the young people who had worked for Bishop Berardi in the Church Office of Human Rights, how are you ever going to expect to get justice in this case? Look what you were facing. You were facing not just the army, a complicit government, a corrupt prosecutor, a corrupt judge, a complicit media. I mean, no useless police. What were you going to do? That's what makes this story, so amazing, and I think really one of the most incredible stories in the history of Latin Americans, many fights for justice. This is actually the story of a victory, the most unlikely victory, and it begins that very night there in the park as the very young people, nobody, I don't think, older than 34, and some as young as 19, gathering there in the park and deciding, what are we going to do? And they make the decision to form their own investigation team in defiance of all of this. And that's really where this story really begins.
Yeah. And if for people, I want to mention again, for people who want to read the story, and it is a remarkable story, we're talking about the book, The Art of Political Murder, the subtitle, Who Killed the Bishop? It is published by Grove Press by our guest, Francisco Goldman. He is a novelist and also has done journalism. This is a nonfiction work. His fiction and journalism have appeared in a lot of places, New Yorker, Harper's, New York Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine. And we're talking about a murder that occurred in April of 1998, so we're just past the 10-year anniversary. It was the murder of Bishop Juan Girardi, who was one of the leading human rights activists in Guatemala. And he was murdered just a couple of days after the issuing of a report that he was involved in putting together, and a lot of other people were involved in putting together, an effort of the church in Guatemala to document deaths and disappearances during the 36-year-long Guatemalan Civil War, heavily implicating the army in many of these deaths, most of these deaths. And if you're interested in reading the story, of course, you can seek out the book. We do have a caller here who's been waiting patiently, and I want to bring them into the conversation. Other people who are listening, well, of course, your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. The caller's in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious, how much support did the generals receive from the, well, the Dulles brothers in the initial overthrow of the Guatemalan government? And what was the role of American government subsequently?
Yes, the Dulles brothers played a key role early on, both because, for various reasons, the reason that's most commonly given for the coup is that their Benz government and their land reform had expropriated land that belonged to the United Fruit Company, paying the United Fruit Company for that land, paying them the price that the company itself had declared, in its tax forms of what it was worth, and of course they'd undervalued it greatly. And both Dulles brothers had links to the United Fruit Company. But it's also important to remember that there was also, this is what was overlooked, a great deal of sort of anti-communist hysteria at work, too, in the decision to do the coup. And then what becomes really important about the U.S.'s support later is if the coup is catastrophic for Guatemala. But what happens in the 1960s is just as catastrophic, because in 1962, when you get the first tiny uprising, which is not necessarily a communist uprising, but everyone, of course, is at this point totally paranoid about what's happening in Cuba and everything. But some dissenting officers who feel that the Guatemalan army has sold itself out by becoming, this kind of U.S. client army, they start a small rebellion, and that rebellion is brutally crushed. But at this point, the U.S. makes a decision to really bolster the Guatemalan military intelligence infrastructure to be kind of the frontline soldiers and in the proxy war down there, if you want to call it that. And that ends up being Guatemala's big nightmare, because these guys get all kinds of money and elite training and CIA training, and they run the death squads and they run the torture cells. And they become incredibly, not just murderous, but like a clandestine world unto itself.
Were they trained at the School of the Americas?
Many of them were. In fact, Kurt, of the three military men who were finally imprisoned for the Girardi case, Colonel Lima is a graduate of the School of the Americas and also of the Army Ranger School. Yeah, most of them received, the big officers received that kind of training. And so, the U.S. made, it's a long story, but to tell it in a simple way, the United States created a Frankenstein monster when they empowered the military intelligence units the way they did. And now it's a big headache because they can't control them anymore.
Actually, same group that helped overthrow the Mossadegh government in Iran, which we're now paying for.
Yeah, yeah. It was the same kind of short-sightedness, yeah.
All right, I thank you for the call. Others are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that at one point the government was advancing this explanation of the crime, implicating Father Mariel, another priest who was living in the same residence.
Right.
The allegation was that there was a homosexual relationship and that there was a third man involved and the killing was involving jealousy. And it got very tangled and very complicated and involved the housekeeper and involved the poor Father Mario's poor dog, which is probably the most innocent party in all of this. And at one point, in fact, Father Mario was indeed charged. Now there is a long and tangled and complicated story here that people, if they want to get the full story, they have to look at the book. But it does indeed turn out eventually, though, that there were three men charged, not Father Mario among them, but three men charged who were involved with the military, who were charged in connection with the murder. How was it that, in fact, these people finally ended up being the target of the investigation and actually ended up being charged?
Well, Father Mario was finally charged and is in jail with the other three.
Yeah.
But that's, like you say, I can explain that later. Let's just say he was complicit. He was in on it and blackmailed and doesn't dare to this day say a word. Mm-hmm. And as somebody said, when the army saw who Bishop Berardi was sharing his parish house with, they must have felt that they'd won the lottery. That's the seam of corruption they could exploit to get in there. Mm-hmm. The way it began to unravel was from the start, the very night of the murder. The very night of the murder, a taxi driver, he made a wrong turn. He let off his passengers. He pulled alongside the church and stopped his taxi because the church is like a dark park at night. It's very dark, and he thought that he would roll a joint and get high. And he looked up at the end of the street. He saw a white Toyota Corolla and a man with no shirt standing outside it, and other men standing around the man with no shirt as if he thought they were detaining him. And he saw that it was the car had a four-digit license plate, which he knew official vehicles had. So he thought, being a drug user himself, that it was a drug bust. And they were undercover. It was an undercover drug unit, and he'd better get out of there. And he backed up and took off. And the next day, when the newspapers were full of, the vagrant who saw a shirtless man step out of the garage door, and this must be the murderer, he said, "Oh my God, I saw Bishop Berardi's murderer." And he didn't know what to do with this information. And so he went to another parish priest, even though he wasn't religious himself, actually. And this poor priest was a very timid, nervous priest who didn't want to be involved in anything. And he was getting dressed for the funeral, and his servant shows this frightened taxi driver in, and he says, tells him what he saw, and he hands him a slip of paper with the license plate print written down on it. And he takes it to the church lawyers, and the church's lawyers run a check on the plate. And it turns out that this plate was once assigned to a military unit, a military base in Chiquimula, which is interesting circumstantially because they'd already received an anonymous tip by telephone that had said, "Check out the Limas, Colonel Lima and his son, Captain Lima." This call, by the way, we eventually learned, was phoned in by Colonel Lima's niece because her mother had spoken to Colonel Lima's wife, who'd overheard them talking about, planning sessions about the murder when it happened, was terrified. And the niece had rebelled against her family and phoned it into the church. And so these two things hooked up, and it was the first lead. And so as I told you, the church decided to form its own unit. It was a group of four men ranging in age from 26 to 19. They named themselves, almost to make fun of themselves, because of what they were taking on, the Untouchables, Los Intocables. And at this point, everybody was looking for the taxi driver. Word had gotten out that taxi driver had seen something, and taxi drivers were turning up dead all over the city, I'm sad to say. And we felt like we were, at this time, I was already reporting on the story for the New Yorker, and I'd made friends with the Untouchables. And we felt like we were in a horrible, gruesome race to see who would find the taxi driver first. And in fact, you know, they had been driving this poor priest around to taxi stands all over the country trying to find this taxi driver. And the priest was getting very nervous and scared because he was getting death threats. And in fact, he finally fled the country. But one murdered taxi driver, the family said he'd been receiving death threats and he'd had an arrest for drug use. And the priest saw his body in the morgue and thought it might be the same guy. And when I remember my friends and the Untouchables were so depressed because they thought the army had gotten the taxi driver first. But then about a week later, that taxi driver turned up and he went back to the priest because he was having marital problems and wanted advice. And the priest said, they are desperate to find you. And he gave him Fernando Penados, one of the Untouchables' beeper number. And that was the start. They got him. They got his testimony. They filmed his testimony. And they got him out of the country to Canada. And this is a case in which every witness had to go into exile. And you know, in a case in which at least 10 people related to the case were murdered along the way. Mm. And countless judges, countless people in exile. And anyway, that was the foundation stone, that first witness. The case these guys were eventually able to build begins there.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's certainly, as you point out, a number of people who had some kind of connection to the case or might have known something or were potential witnesses, it was dangerous to be close in any way possible,
yeah,
to this.
They were desperate. Once they realized that they'd made a mistake, that there'd been a flaw, right, that the taxi driver had seen this guy and written down the plate number, it became an incredible, it still is, you know, to this day, because even now they're desperate to keep the case from going higher. It's a very dangerous case, and they were desperate to stop it. And they thought that whole first scenario about railroading the priest into prison as the sole murderer, they thought that was going to be a slam dunk. There'd be a hearing, and the judge would say, you're guilty, and that would be that. But the church fought back. They started to, you know, develop a counter case. They took it to the media. They pushed to get their witnesses heard. And they got some extraordinary forensics experts of their own, came down as volunteers from the United States and completely surprised the government. They didn't expect it. When this guy, Dr. Norman Sperber, who has been the official dental forensics expert at trials of people like Arthur Bremer and so forth, mm-hmm. You know, he designed the FBI's dental identification office. And they're a real expert. Out of the blue, they came down as volunteer experts for the church when they did an exhumation of the bishop's corpse to check for dog bites, which they had all set up. You know, they thought only that crazy Spaniard was going to be there. And so they managed to blunt that. The exhumation was very dramatic, and these American experts really, you know, played a great role. And so finally that corrupt judge and that corrupt prosecutor were forced to resign in disgrace, and that opened up the case. There was an honest prosecutor came in. He was based on the witnesses that my friends in the church had found. He had been able to develop on his own. He was about to issue arrests against the military, and then the military made it clear that they were ready to abduct and kill his children, so he fled the country. And then a man I think of as the true hero of the Harardi case, a young prosecutor, 34 years old, no experience, named Leopoldo Zasek, came in, newlywed, infant child. He put up with almost 2.5 years of the most incredible death threats, near assassinations. He showed so much courage, and he just dug in there and developed the two most important witnesses, I think. And eventually, in June of 2001, the case went to trial. in which with witnesses that have been found both by the church, which by now had legal status as sort of co-prosecutors, and this very heroic, I think, prosecutor Leopoldo Zasek. And it was the first time in Guatemalan history that military men had been found guilty of participating in a politically motivated extrajudicial execution. Mm-hmm. The key witness that Leopoldo Zasek found and developed, of course, was Ruben Chinnox, that very vagrant who'd been outside the front door that night, whose job it was to shout to the media that he saw the shirtless man.
Yeah.
He immediately went into police custody and had been forgotten about. When Zasek took him out of this hotel and eventually got him to talk, it's very dramatic, and it turned out that he was a deep cover military intelligence operative. And he's the one who really helped crack the case.
Three men were found guilty. They were all people who had ties to the country's military intelligence apparatus. One of them was, in fact, the former head of military intelligence. Another one was his son. And there was a third man who...
He was kind of a thug, yeah.
He was kind of a thug. And actually, one of the things that's interesting about this guy was that you, at least initially, it seemed like he had a pretty good alibi because he was in jail.
Right.
At the time, although it turned out that, well, that wasn't, it was like he was in jail, except they didn't bother to lock the door.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the most astonishing witnesses when Zasek finds that prisoner who was a witness and willing to, you know, who was a witness to the way he was in a little prison. He had been involved and he'd been part of the president's, because this intelligence group is called the Presidential Military Staff, and aside from being the most ruthless and dangerous and deeply clandestine intelligence unit in Guatemala, they also are responsible for the president's security. And he had been recklessly driven a milk truck in front of the president when he was out horse riding. Anyway, this guy was in jail for just a year for having murdered this guy who got too close. Having fired a pistol into the head of this guy who had given the president the scare. And it turned out that, and it was, a fascinating piece of testimony, the way that witness told it, and the way they found that witness, and the way they got him out of it. And he told how he was basically being chauffeured back. He could leave the prison pretty much whenever he wanted. He only had to be there for the morning and evening roll call. And that prison was only 20 minutes from the city, and he was, he was a kind of a hitman. He was a big, he wasn't an elite officer at all. He was your classic thug, and he was being driven back and forth from the city to the prison, when they needed him to do dirty jobs, basically.
We're coming to the point here where we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and I think one important point that I want to go on to and have you talk a little bit about is the issue of who above the level of these guys
right.
knew about this or perhaps in fact were responsible for organizing this and setting it in motion, because I think it very clearly the feeling was that this this did not start with Colonel Lima Estrada and his son, and this man Jose Obdulio Villanueva, who was the thug who had the part-time incarceration plan.
Yeah,
the thought was in fact that this was something that it went up to a much higher level.
It went up to you couldn't have done a murder like this without the very highest people involved. This army, this was a murder that was going to put the Guatemalan peace process at risk, but it was a murder sending the gravest message: do not defy the amnesty. And and why did everything rest on the amnesty? Because the Guatemalan, in the peace process, the Guatemalan military intelligence units, according to the peace accords, are supposed to be turned over to civilians. Why aren't they? Right? This is a murder that really links the Cold War era of politics to the contemporary era where politics and organized crime are the same. Those military intelligence units now have become incredibly lucrative. They're basically involved in narco trafficking. 70% of all the cocaine that reaches the United States, according to the DEA, gets transshipped through Guatemala. These are the guys who are doing it. right? So if you begin to prosecute these officers for human rights violations from the past and make these military intelligence units turn civilian, you're basically taking away this incredibly lucrative, powerful business. And so that's what's at stake, and that's why it was so important for them to punish, right, and to intimidate. And if it was a crime that had to be, the top chieftains of military intelligence, the most powerful men in Guatemala, had to be in on it. It's unthinkable that lower down people would have dared to do this by themselves. And they know who they are. You know, people know their names. They've been implicated by other witnesses, such as General Perez Molina, Colonel Rudy Pozuelos, people very close to former President Arzu, including relatives, son, perhaps. If this case goes higher, you're treading on the heels of you're beginning to nip at the heels of very, very powerful people and going right into the vortex of where political power and organized crime intersect.
What happened to these three men, the colonel, his son, and Villanueva?
Well, the colonel and his son, Captain Lima, are still in prison. Villanueva was murdered during a prison riot. The prison riot happened because Captain Lima was basically running the drug trade in the prison and was doing it in a very heavy, you know, he's become very wealthy in prison, they say, and he was doing it in a very ham-fisted way that was really marginalizing and infuriating the famous Maras, those gangster kids. And so there was a prison riot, and they broke through out of their cell block, and they were chanting, basically, get Captain Lima, get Captain Lima. You know, these so-called the Maras, the gang youths. And they got into that cell block, and Captain Lima was nowhere to be found, but they got a hold of Obdulio Villanueva, and they decapitated him.
Do you think that, in fact, Obdulio Villanueva was the man who was actually the murderer, the one who actually committed the murder?
You know, one of the things I love about this story are the enigmas. There are certain things that we just never know. Until we get higher, we won't know. It's certainly possible that he was Hugo. That's the name we have for the shirtless man.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is there were at least two people inside. Because when people who really know what they're talking about look at the wounds and so forth, they say that Bishop Hardy had to have been attacked by two people, one probably using brass knuckles, and the other probably using like a lead pipe. And so who were the two? It easily could have been Villanueva, one of them. Or then again, he might have had the job that he was found guilty of, which was been arriving after to alter the crime scene, you know, which is what they were actually, that was the role that Lima certainly had. And some people think that there is a legendary military assassin in Guatemala underground known as Hugo, and that if he exists, it's very possible he's been killed since then, and you know, or that's one of those things that is a big mystery still at the heart of the case, the exact identity of who that shirtless man was and who exactly was it inside the garage.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly know there were a lot of military men around there that night. There's all sorts of almost like very curious, almost laughable pieces of evidence, such as the fried chicken delivery receipt to Padre Mario a couple of hours before the murder, you know, where he was obviously feeding about three different people. And who were they? You know, I have a hunch I know who they were, but I think these are all the things that are going to come out. And it's very important to realize that the case has a good chance to go forward. They've got lots of evidence developed against higher-ups now. The last government closed down the office of the special prosecutor in the Harardi case, but the new government has reopened it. And so they're getting ready to go. And they have a lot more new evidence. And, of course, the big question always is there anything that can make this priest talk? He's been kept his mouth shut for 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
and won't say a word. And you know whether it's out of reasons of personal shame or he's just horrified of his mother finding out, you know, or because he's very close to his mother. Who knows? But people are always holding out the hope that he'll finally relent and tell what he knows. But we'll see. I would expect to see in the next round of events Colonel Pazuelos and Major Escobar Blas, for sure. There's a lot of evidence against those two guys. Mm. And that would get you one rung below the very highest people.
It's a remarkable story and a remarkable piece of journalism. The book is The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? It's published by Grove Press by our guest Francisco Goldman. He is the author of three novels, The Long Night of White Chickens, The Ordinary Seaman, and The Divine Husband. His fiction and journalism have appeared in many places, including The New Yorker, Harper's, New Yorker Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine. Mr. Goldman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's really been a great pleasure, David. Thank you.